Okay, my name is Dr. Tony Fauci, and I'm speaking to you here from my office on the campus of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. You can never say absolute yes or no, but we feel reasonably confident that there is an extraordinarily low probability that there would be an outbreak. We feel confident about that because outbreaks occur in situations in which one cannot do isolation and contact tracing. We have a healthcare system, albeit not perfect, that does have the capability of doing the kind of identification. If someone were to come over here who was unknown to have Ebola and then had Ebola here in the United States, we could do the kind of contact tracing that over the years, and I think the American people need to know that, since 1976, there have been 24 outbreaks that the United States CDC and others have been involved with containing, and it was done by isolation, contact tracing. And that's the thing that quells an epidemic that stops an outbreak. So one looks in Africa and sees an extraordinarily difficult situation there. That's because the healthcare structure there is not capable, given the burden of disease, to do that. We feel confident that our situation here in the United States, our capability to do that, we're not overconfident. And that's the reason why what we're doing is putting into place measures of monitoring, measures of making sure that we have a system that we can do this kind of isolation very well. So it's not overconfidence, but it's feeling that we can do the job and protect the American people. Well, people who feel that we should essentially close the borders and not allow people into our country from West Africa, one can understand why they feel that way. The U.S. government official position has been that we feel we can dramatically diminish an already low risk of someone coming in by doing things that are superimposed upon a system that is not perfect, but that we can make it even a less risk. We feel that if we don't know where people are coming from, so let's say we close the borders, then people will, because human nature is that way, will be able to make it more difficult to track them. Not impossible, but more difficult to track them. Because if you know everyone that's coming into the country, we're going to come to five airports, are going to have exit and entry screening, and will be proactively monitored in an active way. If you close off a border, it is certainly conceivable that people will go to other countries whose borders were not closed to our entry, and then it would make it that much more difficult to track. In addition, there are other things. If we do that, it is likely that it will be much more difficult for the country in question to be able to fight their own epidemic. As we've said so many times, the best way to protect Americans is to suppress the epidemic in West Africa. And if we shut them out and make them economically less able, politically less able, even put some instability in the country, it might be very, very difficult for them to do what we need them to, is to help us help them control their own epidemic. That's one of the reason, and probably the most important reason, why we feel it might be counterproductive to do that. One always asks the question of whether or not it's possible that Ebola can become airborne. Our experience over many, many years with Ebola clearly indicates that first, it's not airborne, number one. And number two, if you look at the possibility, what you have to do is look at science and evidence-based facts. It's an RNA virus. It replicates, and RNA viruses mutate. However, most of those mutations are not associated with a relevant functional change. Some are, but if you look historically at viruses, it is virtually unheard of. And again, I always say you never say never and you never say always, but there are no prior examples, and it's relatively unheard of that a virus by mutating would completely change its modality of transmissibility. So A, it's not airborne now, and although it is not impossible for it to become airborne, it would be an extraordinarily unlikely event for that to happen. Well, again, you have to be careful when you say that, because the only time you get Ebola in the lung in sufficient quantities to be able to get into fluid that would come out in a sneeze is when you have extraordinarily advanced disease. We know that in general, a typical Ebola case doesn't have a lot of virus in the lung, but we do know that an advanced case that would likely be so sick that they're almost terminal could have a lot of virus in the lung. So if someone is, for example, being intubated because they're in extremis and the person coughs up or sneezes up, the healthcare worker, if not properly protected, could be at risk for that. But it is very, very, I think, a stretch to say that therefore someone who's walking around, who's infected, who is well enough to even be in society to sneeze, would have Ebola in their lung to be able to spread. So you've got to be careful that you don't create a scenario that's so hypothetical and so unrealistic that it almost never can happen. Focus on the fact that it is direct contact with bodily fluids that could be mucus, that could be blood, that could be vomit, that could be diarrhea of a person who's sick. And that's the reason why healthcare workers are the ones at most risk, particularly if they don't have the proper personal protective equipment. A person without symptoms who is infected and in the very early stage but doesn't have any symptoms, that person does not transmit virus. And we know that from years and years of experience. So although I can understand the hypothetical question about trees, in reality, it is almost a scenario that wouldn't occur. Well, first of all, you cannot predict when a vaccine would be ready because vaccines are still experimental. We've made considerable progress with vaccines. We have vaccine candidates, more than one. Two that are already in people. One are vaccines that have shown to be quite effective in an animal model. But experience tells you that often, even something that works in an animal model, when you get into a human, it is either not safe or it's not effective. Having said that, we are in phase one trials with two vaccines now that are looking at, is it going to be an adverse event? Would it be toxic? If it's safe, does it then induce the kind of response that you would predict would be protective? If that's the case, we should know that by probably November, because we started the trials, one in the beginning of September and one in early October. By the November time point, we'll know. And at that point, we will expand the trials into thousands of people in the West African setting to determine if it actually works and if it does not give a paradoxical harmful effect. If all of those things go as we hope, and there's a big as we hope because you can never guarantee, we could know conceivably by several months into 2015 whether or not a vaccine works or not. And obviously, if it does, then we would ratchet up to make it widely distributed and available to the people of West Africa. Well, the answer is very, very unlikely if you have no symptoms. We know that more than 90% of people have fever who are as one of their first symptoms. The Ebola PCR, which stands for polymerase chain reaction, which is a molecular test. It's not culturing the virus. It determines the molecular component of the virus. That PCR test becomes positive right around the time when the symptoms begin. The issue is that if you don't have any symptoms, it is likely that the virus titer is so low, A, that the PCR might not even pick it up, and B, that it would not be in a way where you can actually transmit it. The answer to the question is, it's almost always right at the time that you have the beginning of symptoms. Now, we're working on much more sensitive, rapid tests. Whether or not that's going to push the ability to detect it earlier, we can't say, but we know now that the PCR is a pretty good test at the time that the person gets the symptoms. Well, rather than say, are we working on better protective gear, we're working on the gear we have to make sure people, A, have it available to them, and B, know how to use it. So the NIH is one of the hospitals that is the referral hospital for people with Ebola. The NIH, Emory, and Nebraska. So here, what we do, myself included, we train, we practice. We put things on in front of someone who's watching us to make sure we put it on, and we have someone called a Watson who watches us as we take it off. So rather than saying new and better PPE, which we're always interested in new and better equipment, more important than new and better equipment is getting that personnel who will be using it to know how to use it in the sense of putting it on and taking it off properly. Right now, all treatments are in the experimental stage. And since they're not done at this point, and we hope we'll get to a point where we can do it a certain way, they're not done in the context of a clinical trial, which means we have nothing to compare it to. So it is dangerous when you give something to someone to say, well, the person got better, therefore it must have been the experimental drug, whatever that drug is. History of medicine says that's a dangerous assumption. The other thing is that unlike a drug that has been proven to be safe and effective, these are experimental. So it's conceivable that not only might they not work, they might actually be too toxic to use. And since a person is so sick anyway with Ebola, you may not be able to distinguish the negative effect or the toxic effect of the drug with the very deleterious effects of the virus on the body. So the answer to the question is we need to do a clinical trial and balance making experimental drugs available to people who might need them with the need to be able to determine if they actually need what we're trying to do, run that delicate balance. Certainly, there is already examples of what we call passive transfer of plasma, taking the plasma from a convalescent Ebola patient who is well, feeling well, with no virus in their blood, and transfer their plasma to someone who does have Ebola to try and help them suppress the virus. In fact, Dr. Brantley, who was the patient who was transferred from West Africa to Emory, has donated multiple units to a number of individuals. So it is certainly conceivable and possible that that might be a modality of treatment. But here again, we don't know if it works. And we and others, we at the NIH, other institutions, are already working on protocols to determine if the passive transfer of plasma actually does have a beneficial effect. Well, again, we have to be careful. By a direct administration of a drug, we don't know because we don't have any drugs that have been proven to be effective. We do know, and this is important, that the human body's immune system is capable of ridding the body of virus, clearing it, and allowing a person to recover. Because we know in the history of Ebola, the recovery rate, and I guess it's important to distinguish recovery from cure. Cure implies you do something with an agent to block the virus and you cure them. Recovery means you could recover by your own natural immune system's ability to clear the virus. So the latter we know is true. Many people can recover. In some situations, the mortality rate is devastating, 90%. In others, it's much, much less. We can talk about a cure after we get a drug that we know we give to someone and the overwhelming majority of them get better. But we're not in that position yet because all of these drugs are still experimental.